Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
We went in his car with his family to this very violent fighting tournament. I mean, it looked like people were getting genuinely knocked out, but he came on at the beginning and they played Prodigy's Firestarter when Chuck Norris came out, and it was just the most surreal thing. I was like, what is going on here? But he was very nice. He was very kind of the anti-Seagal, really, where he's not really mythologizing himself. He's been quite humble.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema. Hello everybody and welcome to Writers on Film. My name is John Bleasdale, I'm a writer and film critic, and today I'm going to be talking to Nick DeSemlin. He is the author of Wild and Crazy Guys, and his latest book is The Last Action Heroes, which is a history, a take on the 1980s phenomenon of the action movie superstar, such as Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sylvester Stallone, among a cast of many others. Nick is the editor of Empire Magazine, and he has written for publications such as Rolling Stone and Time Out. The conversation is brilliant and features much Steven Seagal chat, as you are about to learn. If you enjoy the episode, please remember to like, to subscribe if you don't already. Leaving a review is very useful. If you have a podcast yourself and you want me to come on and talk about films, I'm more than happy to. I'd love to spread the love around a little bit. Also, our sister podcast, Cinema Italia, is restarting or has already restarted. So please go over and give that a listen. It's an English language podcast celebrating a love of Italian cinema from Cabiria to the present day. So Cabiria to Sorrentino, if you like. There's also a podcast called Connery, which is a little bit different, but if you want to hunt it out, it's available on all podcast platforms. It's read by Kai Ross and written by me, and it is a speculative novel about a young man who takes Sean Connery a little bit too seriously and is entirely, to every detail, autobiographical. There's not a single detail there that isn't based on something that has happened to me in my life. If you listen to the first few episodes, you will understand how frightening that might be. But before you do any of that, please enjoy the conversation. Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen a Steven Seagal film except Executive Decision, and I went to see that because Kurt Russell was in it, and I was in a little bit of a Kurt Russell renaissance.
Yeah, that which is probably the least Steven Seagal film, because, well, A, he dies, and B, he's like play second fiddle to someone, which he hated doing. And he claims that he got paid $1 million a day. I don't know how true that is. There's no verifying anything he says, but he claimed he got paid $1 million a day to do that for a week or however long he was on it. But he didn't want to get thrown out of the plane. But like I said in my book, there were some people who had worked with him who were cheering when they went to the film and saw that happening.
Who was it? Harry Cohen, the famed Hollywood producer who was loathed, died, and they had his funeral and the church was packed, and some wit turned around and said, give the people what they want and they will come.
that just about sums it up with Mr. Seagal as well. But I got to admit, I'm not a Steven Seagal completist. I haven't he kind of makes films faster than any human can watch them. There was a clip going around of something he made recently on Twitter. I don't know if you saw the X over Christmas of Steven Seagal's sex scene, but he's wearing a leather jacket and he doesn't take it off.
Oh dear.
In fact, he doesn't take any of his clothes off, and it's
mercifully.
But yeah, his work ethic, it probably that speaks volumes about how much energy he puts into films.
What was the name of the film? Frottage.
It might well have been. I don't want to go back and look.
I was really curious about Seagal reading the book, and I mean, he's a hilarious character for many, many reasons. Did you ever meet him, by the way? Did you ever have an interview with him or even approach him? I mean, I'd be kind of scared.
I thought best not to approach him for the book because I don't think he doesn't do a lot of press these days, and he lives in Russia, and I just thought it's opening a Pandora's box. I did do an hour interview on the phone with him for Empire, which is kind of where I drew a lot of the material that I used firsthand from him in the book. I'd got my time zones wrong in classic fashion, and so I hadn't really finished my research, and I got a call from Steven Seagal while I was sitting in the office, and I remember like frantically scrambling to IMDb to pull up his list of film titles, and then realized it doesn't help because every film title is the same. They're all three words. They've all got the word kill in it. And so, I was kind of muddling through, but it was a very surreal conversation. At one point, he was kind of shit talking Van Damme, and he was claiming he could do every stunt that any human could do, all that kind of stuff you expect from him. And then at one point he started kind of rhapsodizing about the horror film The Hills Have Eyes, but not the original, the remake that no one else. And he said he was really into that, but he didn't like the lighting. And I that note about him not liking the lighting of The Hills Have Eyes remake has stuck in my brain.
Oh my word. I mean, some of these guys have this strange... I was at a press conference with Russell Crowe this summer, and he started halfway through the press conference. He started organizing where they should place the speakers in the future. sort of like, you know what, guys, you should have the speaker. And it wasn't as if like, what a complete a-hole, but at the same time, what a complete a-hole.
Yeah. Who's going to stop him? I guess. But that's an off piece to do in a press conference. But then I had my Steven Seagal experience, and an hour is quite a long time to spend in the mind of exploring the psyche of Steven Seagal. So that was quite a treat. And then I was given tickets to go see him perform at Camden at the Roundhouse with his band Thunderbox, and I went along because you kind of have to. And he was there in a purple muumuu, essentially a large purple dress, singing Wild Thing. And it was very peculiar, the whole thing. But yeah, that was my Steven Seagal experience.
But who was there? I mean, who would go and see Steven Seagal in a muumuu voluntarily? I mean, apart from you.
It might have just been him and his large entourage filling the entire building. I don't know. But there were people. I think there was a lot of ironic undertones to the attending people. But there was a lot of screaming. And it was pretty fantastic. It was quite a memorable night.
I mean, did you ever get to the... And I promise we are going to talk about other people. but I was just so fascinated by this.
Let's just talk about Steven Seagal's musical career.
Didn't we do the same thing with Bruce Willis last
Yeah, last we did, actually.
There's a theme developing here. And we can repeat the Bruce Willis conversation as well, obviously. The one thing I was really curious about was obviously there is a large amount of, to be kind, self-aggrandizing, mythologizing that goes on with him, talking about his missions in the CIA and stuff. But has anybody actually ever just done a straightforward biography and just said, look, this guy, you know, this is what this guy actually did. He was in Japan at this point, but he didn't do that, and he did do this. Has anybody sifted through the bullshit, so to speak?
I think it's very difficult to, honestly, at this point. There is so much bullshit that it's like trying to, you know, scoop up the Atlantic with, you know, an egg cup. And it's there's too much of it, and there's too many lies. And, you know, I went back to all the articles when he was breaking through. He had a very dramatic breakthrough. Unlike anyone else in this book, it was like his first film that turned him into an A-list movie star. And he didn't have to do, you know, what Schwarzenegger and Stallone did all those years in the mines of doing bit parts and working up to Warner Brothers just put him in a film. And so there were lots of profiles of him you know, at that time, at the end of the 80s, and who is this guy? And there were, this is LA Times piece. Everyone is trying to sift through it. But even then, no one is able to get to the facts. And so, I mean, I kind of enjoyed that about writing about him, is you're writing about someone who is like a movie character. He's like a, you know, he's like a ridiculous B-movie character, but he's real somehow. So that was like, I kind of enjoyed it every time he came back into the story. It kind of gave the book a bit of an energy boost. But no, I mean, I tried to sift through some of the mythology, and, you know, one of the most famous stories about him is that the legend of him getting into a fight with this stunt guy on the set of one of his early films. And, you know, the rumor goes that he was choked out and he shattered himself and woke up.
Polish underpants.
Yeah, Polish underwear. And, you know, apparently, you know, as one version of the story goes, he passed out and then woke up and then got choked out again. And so he's very angry about this being repeated. Like, quite recently, he's gone on a rant about hating, you know, being furious about it. So I tried to get to the bottom of it, and I spoke to two people who were kind of there, and one of them said it happened, and one of them said it didn't happen. So it's anyone's guess, but I kind of like the Rashomon-ness of everything involving Steven Seagal.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you live by the bullshit, you die by the bullshit. Yeah.
I think that's the tagline for Hard to Kill.
Okay, so let's go back to the beginning, if you like. Of I mean, this it's so complements your earlier book in the sense that you're looking, it's like a biography of a genre and a sort of a historical moment in film, and you're looking at a time period and a genre which is kind of neglected as well. You know, 80s comedy, it hasn't had the amount of attention that you gave it in your first book. And likewise with the action movies, the last action movie, last action stars. Is that the correct title?
Last Action Heroes.
Last Action Heroes. Sorry, of course, from the film. Again, these are films which are largely sort of disregarded or snubbed or whatever. It's not, you're not necessarily arguing critics, you should really, you know, these films need reappraising in any way, but the stories behind the people are just fascinating, and none more fascinating, I think, Arnold Schwarzenegger, which is the kind of where it all begins, right?
Yeah, Schwarzenegger and Stallone were the two kind of the early ones, and then the others all kind of jumped in their wake, and probably wouldn't have happened had it not been for those two. I mean, Schwarzenegger is unbelievable. I think I mentioned in the book, there was one point in like the early 90s where he started talking about himself in the third person interview, because even he had kind of, you know, lost track of who he was. He was like more than a human. And I think that's what kind of appealed to me about these guys, writing about them. And you're right, like their filmographies, it's not like, we're not talking about Orson Welles here. There is a lot of absolute, dreg. And I had to wade through all of it, because I was being quite, assiduous in like following, like watching everything they'd done as much as I could. And there was a lot of terrible stuff, but there was something about their personalities and the cult and the way people treated them and how famous they got, like how famous Arnold got. I don't think there's anyone, not even Tom Cruise, was quite at that level where you can't believe this is a real human being. And, his car parking space in Hollywood at his agency was like a giant slab of terrazzo marble where people would leave roses. And it was just wild. They're like everything involving him. And then he just got bigger and bigger and bigger, to the point where you thought this guy cannot get any bigger. And then he did. And that's kind of why it was fun to write about him in counterpoint to Stallone, because Arnold does not fail until the very end of the book, whereas Stallone is failing all the time, and he's this tortured artist, whereas Arnold has none of that. He doesn't read books. He's just there to make money, and did it really well. But it's a really interesting dynamic between those two, because they're kind of both big muscle men, but also polar opposites in a weird way.
Yeah, I mean, I think the first film that Arnold sort of hits people, breaks through, is the documentary Pumping Iron. And I only really watched this recently, and I was absolutely sort of shocked by how amazing he is in that. There are bits of it that are a little bit fictional, to be fair. It's not there's a few editing tricks and a few scenes which are a little bit set up. But his personality comes through as this uber confident, uber Monch, you know, a guy who's just, you know, I mean, he's taking the world by storm.
Yeah, and the one-liners are there in Pumping Iron, like before I'll Be Back and, you know, anything from Conan. It was like, pumping is like coming, I love to come, milk is for babies, you got to drink beer. And like all of these one-liners just coming out of him. And then you've got him just, you know, smoking weed and spiking out people as well, which you get like all the way through his career with Stallone. You know, he has this really mischievous side to him, this big, like burly guy, but he's like this little impish guy at the same time. He's like playing tricks on his enemies. And you see that in Pumping Iron where he's just like, you know, psyching people out.
It's Lou Ferrigno, the Incredible Hulk actor, is his sort of like the up and coming young guy. And,
yeah.
And he comes down to breakfast with him and his mum and dad. And he's like, oh, you know, and he's joking with them, even though it's just like, I'll beat you tomorrow. Don't you worry about it.
Yeah, he's just messing with everyone. And, you know, there are stories from all through his career, from Predator with like, he would loosen the bolts on the bottom of someone's trailer. So when they'd go in their trailer, the whole thing would like fall over, to like messing with, like, I can't remember who it was, but there was like some big guy that he was working with. He would mess with their, he would get the costume lady to like tighten the thing. So, or loosen it. So they would feel like they're losing muscle. And I don't know, there was some way he was tricking them into thinking that they were losing muscle definition. It's like quite like nefarious mischief, bits of mischief he was doing. But yeah, like right away, you're right. Like Pumping Iron is the start of all that, for sure.
And then when he goes into movies, there's always this sort of like, how do we get around the fact that he has this very broad German accent? And how do we, you know, he's obviously verbally not very, he's not going to be great, even though in Pumping Iron he's verbally fantastic. He's got his comedy. He's got his comedy in Pumping Iron is, he's funnier in that than he is in Twins, I would argue.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a funnier film. It's just kind of insane. And yeah, it's interesting because, you know, Conan the Barbarian and then Terminator were his two breakthrough roles, but they're not funny. Although kind of Terminator is when you watch it, but it's like he is not being funny. He's being very, very deadpan, but it gets big laughs when he does some things, not everything. So I guess there's a bit of that personality shining through. But yeah, he's kind of effortlessly funny in a way, again, with Sly, who was really funny in real life, actually. And one of the joys of writing this book was reading every interview Sly did, or watching every interview he did for like a few decades. And he is such a funny guy, so clever, and has a great turn of phrase. But yeah, whenever Sly tried to do a comedy, it flopped. Whereas Arnold's, there was something about it just made people laugh. And I think it was because he's not trying. It's so obvious he's not trying. He's just, you know, it's like effortless.
I was talking to a friend of mine who was with Sylvester Stallone walking across a back lot in America, in Hollywood. And he was telling me, you know, Sly's really clever guy. He's really intellectual. He's got a lot of stuff, you know, and you can have and he was explaining to me, he was having this conversation with me, and he was explaining, you know, Paul Klee or something that was in his head. And, you know, some guys from the prop department walked by and went, "Hey, Sly." And he was like, "Oh, how you doing, guys?" And he's just like, you don't need to, you know, you have to, he flips into this sort of persona that he can't, it's almost like, no, I can't just be myself in front of other people.
Yeah, there's that weird inner conflict because he hated it. Like when Rocky came out and was huge, everyone started calling, "Hey, Rocky." Everyone would say that to him and he got really angry about it. He hated it. And to the point where he would stop speaking to people if they did it to him. But then he would go back and make endless Rocky films, and he would get a statue of himself as Rocky, you know, at a swimming pool, which he just Instagrammed the other day. And so, you know, it's like he has this real love-hate relationship with certain things that change over the years, and he'll hate it, then he'll go back to it. So his image definitely fluctuates. And I think he's someone who was never entirely comfortable with his image and his persona, never quite knew. In, you know, the opposite way, Arnold, I think, was like always Arnold. And there's a real through line and consistency.
I mean, that's partly, I think, there's a sense that Sly wants to be, you know, a hyphener. He wants to be a writer, director, star. And he's always got that ambition, you know, linked to the 1970s filmmakers that he's coming from. You know, he makes films like Demolition Alley and what's the Fist.
Paradise Alley.
Paradise Alley, sorry, and Fist.
Yeah.
which I've actually seen, which is like a, it's kind of Hoffa, isn't it? It's a sort of Hoffa.
It's kind of Hoffery. Yeah, he's not bad in it, actually. It's definitely better than Capone, which is one of the worst of his early films. But Pfister's got some, you know, Norman Jewison directing, and it's got some good stuff in it. He was not such a fan of Stallone afterwards, because he, again, like, one recurring through line is that he tries to take over every film that he's involved in and edits it himself. And he wasn't allowed to, sorry, angry at the takes that were used of him. So he doesn't like it, but it's got some good stuff in it. And it's definitely an unusual Stallone movie.
Yeah, I mean, it stands next to, you know, Danny DeVito's Hoffa, for instance, which was with Jack Nicholson, which was from a David Mamet screenplay. And but I guess what I was sort of thinking was, when he makes Rocky and then later on First Blood, he makes them as kind of, you know, it sounds a bit of a snobbish thing to say, but like real movies. That is genuinely his ambition. And then he kind of turns them into franchises himself. You know, he has these real characters, and then he turns them into cartoonish versions of themselves.
Yeah, literally in the case of Rambo, who's got his own cartoon series. Although Sly didn't do the voice, sadly, unlike, you know, the Jackie Chan adventures. There were lots of these guys got cartoons made of them. Chuck Norris as well. It's so
weirdly
weird.
Inappropriate.
So inappropriate. Like, what child should be watching a Chuck Norris cartoon? But yeah, you're right. I mean, I over the summer I got to kind of host a screening of First Blood Part 2, the second Rambo film. Mm. And I watched the first one and that one kind of back to back to kind of prep for it. And it is just whiplash. It's like 180 degrees. It couldn't be more different. And the first one feels like a 70s movie. Like you said, it feels like a real authentic movie. It's got great dialogue. It's got really interesting character. Although Tarantino's not a fan. I can't remember who he said he would have cast instead of Stallone, but yeah, he's not a fan of the first Rambo film, which is interesting. But I think it's widely accepted, other than that, that it's a far superior film to the second one, which is just pure cartoon.
Tarantino's been wrong about things. I mean,
he's been known to have wild opinions. Yeah,
and I mean, his book Cinema Speculation, which I enjoyed reading, it was a riot, but you can tell he's not got an editor. You can tell there's nobody pushing back and saying, you want to just check a few things here, and because there's,
you know, are you sure you want to do that?
Yeah, or just, you know, like consistency and stuff like that, and not repeating yourself.
It has a chapter on Paradise Alley, actually, funnily enough, which is a very underwritten about. So I kind of appreciated that he did a chapter. I wasn't entirely clear why he loves that film so much. It's not one I love, but it was kind of a key early one. And yeah, Tarantino does a whole chapter on it, which I thought was interesting.
So we've got Stallone and Schwarzenegger going head to head, and you sort of, you know, you put their rivalry goes all the way through the book, really. It starts very early on and then heads off. And then you get like Chuck Norris and later Van Damme. But I mean, Chuck Norris is coming out of, I mean, that's what's interesting. There are certain characters here that are sort of in the background, but very influential. So like Bruce Lee is a ghost that haunts the banquet, so to speak. Mm. And I was kind of wondering, what if Bruce Lee hadn't died? You know, do you think he would have had an American career that would have, you know, continued and got bigger and bigger?
I think so. I mean, it kind of alluded Jackie Chan, who, you know, I chronicle, that's his kind of arc in the book, is him trying to break into Hollywood, and he was unsuccessful for quite a long time. I think Bruce Lee would have, I think there was such a cult around him, and those early films were so strong and so beloved, and they were already, you know, he had a big LA premiere for Enter the Dragon, which, you know, he died sadly just before. But I do think it would have been a very different landscape. And I think to an extent, quite a few of these guys were jumping into that void that, you know, when Bruce Lee died, there was that big gap left and people were looking to fill it. And I mean, that's literally how, you know, Jackie Chan was in one of those kind of knockoff movies. There were lots of knockoff movies, you know, something, The Dragon this, The Dragon that. So I think that definitely probably, you know, played a part in Jackie Chan's ascent. Yeah, I think he would have gone to America. I don't know what he would have made. I don't know which directors he would have worked with. But there's an argument that, you know, he made these perfect films and then, you know, passed away, and so it's kind of captured in amber, him at his absolute height. And would he have come to America and they wouldn't really have known what to do with him? That's possible. But yeah, he is, like you said, he's this kind of specter hanging over things, because he was so huge at that time in the kind of, you know, 60s, 70s.
And Chuck Norris is sort of coming, you know, part of his kudos that he gets is that he worked with Bruce Lee, and so he has his own martial arts schools, and he's but he also takes a while to sort of actually come into any sort of prominence.
Yeah, well, he couldn't act, which I mean, you could argue that, like, I think he was quite open about it as well. It's interesting.
Tap dancing around that.
No, I mean, he kind of admits it, I think, you know, and, you know, his best friend, Bob Wall, who was very good value that I talked to, was the same. He said he didn't think he had a chance of making it. But he was kind of the joke. He kind of remained a joke, to be honest, to a lot of people. But it's interesting that when he started, he was credible in a way that, you know, he could really kill you with any limb, unlike Bruce Willis or, you know, a few of these guys. Chuck Norris was actually lethal. He was a black belt. He was really, really, like, formidable. Bruce Lee really respected him. So he started out from a point of actually being very credible. And then I think the movies he made was so kind of trashy. Fun. Like, I kind of, you know, I actually... when it came time to put on a Chuck Norris, you know, canon film, they're quite fun. They're so ridiculous. They're not good films, but there's something quite charming about him. I think his screen persona, it's just, he's so wooden and kind of likable. But yeah, he was in a film, he fought Bruce Lee on screen, and that gave him a big boost. But yeah, there were all these other things going on. There's a big karate boom happening around the world, but especially in America, people were getting really into karate, and that was like being shoehorned into everything. And so it was like the right place at the right time, and he just kind of magically became this pretty sizable star without any of his films really like making huge amounts of money. But he was quite a reliable, he did well enough that, and then obviously has become this kind of cult folk hero of, you know, internet memes and everything. And
Chuck Norris, he runs so much until the running machine gets tired. You know, and that, you have a whole list of these, which is amazing. That, I mean, he's become a joke without being the butt end of the joke. He seems to win all the jokes.
Yeah, and he's kind of rolls with it. He's a very, you know, I had a surreal experience flying to Austin, Texas, and spending like a weekend with him. There were like a couple of US Marshals with him, and it wasn't clear whether they were guarding him or whether he was guarding them. and it was surreal. I kind of interviewed him. It's the only time I've ever been asked to pray before an interview. That's never happened before or since. But he said, let's pray. Then we did a career interview, and then we went in his car with his family to this very violent fighting tournament. I mean, it looked like people were getting genuinely knocked out, but he came on at the beginning, and they played Prodigy's Firestarter when Chuck Norris came out, and it was just the most surreal thing. I was like, what is going on here? But he was very nice. He was very kind of the anti-Seagal, really, where he's not really mythologizing himself. He's been quite humble.
That it comes across time and time again in the book, where, you know, there's a story that you tell, which I think is amazing, of him going into a bar and sitting down and somebody coming in and sort of saying, "That's my stool, asshole, get out." And the bar's empty, so there's no, you know, and he just goes, "Oh, okay," and lets him have it.
Yeah. And then, yeah, he's very much the Ned Flanders of this group of like action stars. But yeah, then the guy realizes who he is and comes over, and he's like, and then, yeah, and then I think the story ends with Chuck Norris inviting him to have a drink with them. And it's just, you know, it's like whatever the opposite of a bar fight is, it's like he's tidying up the bar.
He's going and mopping up after everybody's finished, putting the chairs on the table. Is that okay? Always leave the place tidier than when you find it. That's my rule.
Always take a dustpan and brush in. Yeah, that's the Chuck Norris way.
Invasion USA and sort of tidy up the bar USA.
But it's interesting because all of these guys have this image of, you know, being these unstoppable killing machines, but it's interesting seeing which ones kind of almost start believing that image themselves. I think Steven Seagal, everything about him trying to play out that image in real life, whereas other ones can like leave it at the door and just, you know, or disarm people, not literally, but just, you know, the other kind of disarm.
There's a bit where Steven Seagal tells one of his directors, "Oh, he was doing a mission at the weekend," just like you'd say, oh, you know, I had a hard night. I went to a couple of parties at the weekend. He's like, oh, I was in South America doing a mission at the weekend.
Yeah, that's amazing. I'm going to start doing that. I'm going to start doing that in issue meetings. But yeah, he would, one of the screenwriters I spoke to was like, yeah, he would come into the room because he would be taking over the script. And as he, in his words, turning it into something really special. And they would say, you know, it's uncomfortable, probably the atmosphere in the room. So they'd be like, Stephen, what have you been up to at the weekend? Yeah. And he'd say, yeah, I can't tell you, it's classified, Wetworks. And he'd have a loaded gun with him. And it's just like, what do you do?
Oh my God.
Amazing.
It's just so, well, I mean, it's no wonder he's living in Russia. I hope he's living on
inside an abandoned uranium plant, I imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm going to go back to Steven Seagal land, and I don't want to go there anymore.
Let's not go there. My fault.
Let's talk about another character who I think, in some ways, is sort of like another of those sort of Chuck Norris sort of characters, where he's not really as tough as his screen persona suggests, which is Jean-Claude Van Damme, who is kind of, again, you use that phrase, disarming. He's sort of so funny and honest and straightforward. Mm. And he's, I mean, when he talks about having a mini affair with Kylie Minogue, he's also very, 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 very funny. I'm assuming there's a double meaning there.
Yeah, he said that to me, actually, when I interviewed him again for Empire Light. We did this hour. It was the same month, actually. I did an hour with Lundgren, an hour with Seagal, an hour with Van Damme, and then I did the Chuck Norris thing in short succession. So that was quite a beefy kind of month. But yeah, I like an hour with Van Damme is just delightful but confusing. You need to have a lie down afterwards because the Kylie Minogue thing he just casually said, and I didn't realize that was like a big news thing, but it kind of blew up into like a big thing online, and I think Carly even made a statement. But he just casually, he's so honest, like he will say anything that's on his mind. There is literally no diplomacy. There's something I love, a detail I love is that he was criticizing Bloodsport while he was promoting Bloodsport. He was saying, oh yeah, you say we could have made a much better film for that money, and you know, the lighting's not good at all. But he, there's something, and you're right, like, what is his kind of lethal skill? It's really just doing the splits and doing high kicks. And in the real world, that's probably not how you would kind of handle yourself in a fight. That probably wouldn't work out that well for you. If you're doing the splits in a car park, you'd probably like...
having sexy buns, that's his other superpower.
Well, he does the splits, then he sort of bares his bottom and wiggles. But, you know, he's... he was just so sort of charming and different to anyone else, so... I think, you know, I'm a big fan of his kind of early Hollywood films, Hard Target and Time Cop. I mean, Time Cop, what a title.
Yeah.
Sudden Death, where he's in an ice rink. It's Die Hard in an ice rink. And everything about what he does is just a bit naff. Like, there's nothing cool. Like, you know, Die Hard is just cool, but then you sort of take it 20 degrees and it's him with a mullet doing the splits in an ice rink and or whatever, you know, I've amalgamated some of his films, but there's a certain sort of naffness to him, but it's quite delightful. And I've got quite a lot of time for him.
It's like Die Hard, but in an IKEA.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
They'll make that. Now you said it, they're going to make it.
Yeah, the ball pit scene. in a Weatherspoons.
It could happen.
I would pay to see the Weatherspoons blow up. That would be good. The giant Jenga scene. I'm stopping now because I've already wasted way too many good ideas.
Write them down.
I'm writing them down right as we speak. Van Damme. So we get Van Damme and we get his sort of, I mean, at this point, you are sort of getting people who are making reasonably successful movies. They're bringing in a profit and everything. And they're definitely feeding an appetite, but they are sort of the second league of the big boys. And the last one I wanted to mention that you feature in the book. Oh no, there's two more we need to talk about, but the last one of this ilk is Dolph Lundgren, who you know, bursts into fame, you know, as Rocky IV's nemesis, Ivan Drago. What was he like to interview? Because this guy can speak like five languages. He's like an astrophysicist, and he's just got so much going for him.
Very, very smart guy. Yeah, I mean, he was on course to be like a chemical engineer, I think, and he's a kind of Mensa genius IQ level. I've interviewed him a few times. He's just completely delightful, completely normal. I got to say, out of this group, probably like the most well-adjusted in terms of you can just have a normal conversation. Like, you can't really have that with any of the others, but that's fine. That's kind of not what you want. But Dolph is, and very kind of philosophical. And I kind of wanted to include him in the book because you wanted to show a whole ecosystem of people. And it doesn't always work. Like, you know, he became instantly famous from doing Rocky IV. Like, you know, he goes into the premiere and he's not famous, and he comes out and he is famous, and his whole life changed. But then it just didn't work out. Like, he couldn't hang on to it until kind of quite recently with The Expendables, he came back, but he was doing direct DVD stuff for quite a long time. But yeah, he's very, very pleasant. And, you know, I love the story about him and Van Damme faking a fight in Cannes for Universal Soldier. And of course it was Van Damme's idea. And of course they pretended they were in a feud, but then Van Damme went on a talk show like a day later and just told the whole world that it was fake. Cause he couldn't help himself. But, yeah, I mean, again, like, not, I don't think Dolph was very lucky with his films. I think a lot of them are pretty bad. But a likable guy. And weird to think of him as kind of the underdog of the group, because he's, like, you know, 7 foot tall, like, giant brick house, you know, blonde, very handsome, you know, and he's got it all. But it's interesting why, you know, Van Damme was bigger than him, for instance. Van Damme's a bit smaller, shorter, you know, doesn't have the bulk. So why does one become an action hero and one does, but then falters? It's kind of interesting.
Well, that brings us on to sort of a figure who seems to be a transitional figure, which is Bruce Willis, who is not the huge, you know, you say right at the get-go, he doesn't want to do Die Hard. He's a comedy actor. He's known for his smirks rather than his biceps. He's not going to spend much time in the gym bulking up. And people, you know, people think it's not going to work. You know, the studio don't think it's going to work. The audience snicker at the trailer. And yet his success is kind of like the beginning of the end for the big muscle, the muscles from Brussels and the muscles from everywhere else.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, it's it was when things started to change, and, you know, at a certain point it had to, because they were getting bigger and bigger. The explosions were getting bigger. The kill counts were getting bigger. So as you go through the 80s, it's just, you're going from Commando to Rambo 2 to, you know, it's like at a certain point it has to scale down a bit. And I think people are getting tired of just the bigness of these spectacles, and it gets numbing. By the time you get to Rambo 3, it's just exhausting. You know, it's just him going around just murdering like 1,000 Russian soldiers. And people wanted something different. And then when Die Hard came along in 88, it was small, it was confined, it had a guy who was, you know, could actually go through an air vent rather than just getting stuck in it. Like, I can't imagine Arnold doing that scene. They would have needed a team of people like greasing him up to get him out of there. But it was just, everything about him was different, which is why it succeeded, but also why it was considered risky and why people were at Fox were terrified of it and, you know, taking his face off the poster. But yeah, he's a really interesting one, Bruce Willis, because I just don't think he ever wanted to do it. I didn't think he was reluctant to do Die Hard 2. He didn't really want to do the first one. He just took it for the money. He was very open about that. And you can kind of see with what he does after Die Hard that he doesn't want to get stuck in that rut of just doing, which is what kind of makes it really tragic. You know, looking at his filmography from the last 15 years, that he did ultimately get stuck in doing these pretty poor quality action movies and really got trapped in there. And I don't think that was where his heart was ever.
Yeah, I was sort of thinking, I mean, he does a Vietnam drama, which is sort of going back to a sort of John Voight-esque, you know, real, you know, the sort of film you would expect to be made by in the early 80s, really. But then he also does like Alan Rudolph films. He does a version of Breakfast of Champions, and he does, you know, 12 Monkeys is a real step out. And then, you know, yeah, I mean, it's not like he's, I don't feel that there's a Bruce Willis persona as such in terms of those action films to quite the same extent. Or is that, you know, I mean, Last Man Standing isn't John McClane in the 1930s. It's just, it's a different character. Yeah. It's a different, you know.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess if there's his action persona is kind of the guy who's pissing off the bad guys, and he does that really well in obviously in Die Hard, kind of sets that. But he does it really well in Last Boy Scout.
Right.
And I've got my. I didn't write about Last Boy Scout in the book because it was kind of outside the timeline. But I have a lot of time for it. I think it's a flawed film. It's very, very cynical and kind of grim and maybe a little bit too much, but it's got lots of brilliance in it. And it's just got a great Bruce Willis pissing people off. like so many great little moments and little scenes. I think that's the film after the original Die Hard that kind of utilized his persona the best. But I guess that would be it. You know, Arnold is just this one-man army, and Willis is the guy who doesn't want to be there, and he's pissed off about it. The others look like they want to be there. I guess that's the difference.
Yeah, the others look like they don't make sense anywhere else. It's like whenever you see them sort of, I mean, in Total Recall, I always remember seeing Arnold with a drill, and, you know, it's like, it's a drill. You don't need muscles. It's got a motor. It's not like, you know, you don't actually need to have those muscles to make that happen.
That's very true. But yeah, that's absolutely true what you just said. And I think, you know, there's that sense in Die Hard. One of the glorious things about it is he doesn't want to be there. Like, the characters don't want to be there, but also Bruce Willis doesn't really want to be there. And you can imagine him, like, you know, he's slipping around, he's slipping out the building, no one can catch him. He was probably like that, you know, it's like at a Planet Hollywood party, he was probably slipping out the back door and everyone was trying to catch him. But yeah, I mean, he was, you know, I don't want to speak of him in the past tense. Obviously, he's still alive. It's very tragic, you know, what's happened, but obviously he's not acting anymore, which is a real tragedy. But he, you know, his performances in quite a few action films have so much charm and charisma, just like raw charisma. And given it was his first action movie, Die Hard is such a great showcase of that.
Yeah, and I'd you know, argue for Hudson Hawk, and I'd argue for a whole bunch of other films. I mean, he also has that talent of being genuinely funny during the action rather than against the action, or you know, just quippage for the sake of quippage. I mean, I've never found like James Bond one-liners or Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know, the kill quip, I've never found them funny. They're just, it's that sort of cringe version of dad jokes, you know, that, you know,
he had not even attempting re-entry.
That's well, the Pierce Brosnan.
No, that's bad.
The Pierce Brosnan, I Thought Christmas Only Came Once a Year, was probably the most sophisticated. That's what I thought when Daniel Craig came along, and people argue that, oh, Daniel Craig's humorless, his Bonds. No, they're actually funny. You know, his Do I Look Like I Give a Damn is genuinely funny, whereas, you know, having the Lawrence of Arabia soundtrack play while Roger Moore goes on a camel across the... I'm getting off track. Talking about someone who is genuinely funny, Jackie Chan. This is this is a character who is an actor who is, as you've already said, trying to break into Hollywood, but kind of doesn't need to because he's got the rest of the world at his feet.
Yeah, well, the interesting kind of sting in the tail of him breaking into Hollywood is he finally does with the Rush Hour films and et cetera, and Rumble in the Bronx. But when he gets there, he realizes that he doesn't really want to be there after all because it's not the way he wants to work. It's not how he makes films. He's not allowed to do what he does best. But yeah, with Jackie Chan, the comedy is so baked into the action. It's the whole persona is funny, intrinsically funny. And, you know, part of that is to do with Bruce Lee. Like we were talking about Bruce Lee and that void that was left behind. But he, I think very consciously was like, I'm going to do something different to Bruce Lee. And he's very serious and solemn. And I'm going to be the opposite. I'm going to be the clown. And, you know, he was brought up learning acrobatics. And you know, so he had the whole kind of clowning skill set. But yeah, it's just... intrinsically funny. Every Jackie Chan film is funny. They've all got brilliant. I watched the Police Story movies on the big screen last year back to back, and the dialogue, funny stuff, doesn't always work. Like there's stuff in the first Police Story where he gets three cakes thrown in his face, which is never funny. I don't think cakes in the face is that funny. But there's slapstick involving his girlfriend, and, you know, it's not that good. But it's the fighting that is just, you know, the little gags that he'll do and using unusual things. And it's just brilliant slapstick. You know, it's just Harold Lloyd, Buster Keaton. It's all that brilliant stuff.
Yeah, there are certain sort of, I'm not sure if it's due to cultural differences, but sort of girls getting hurt. It seems to be something that that there's more tolerance of, and it's considered funnier than maybe where
and cake violence. Those two things maybe don't travel quite so well.
But maybe you go back to Buster Keaton or Stan Laurel and Hardy have a lot of women getting hurt and a lot of cakes being thrown around. Yeah, lots of pies. Exactly. I was interested as well in how the state of action, you know, that we keep using this phrase action cinema, action hero. And it's kind of interesting to sort of look at this in a way as how does that develop through this period that you're looking at? You know, I'm thinking of like when you start having something like The Matrix come in and completely reinvent what we're expecting to see in a fight scene. You know, what we're all or Crouching Tiger, you know, always coming from the east, and suddenly you've got this you know, going to Casino Royale and that initial chase where you have what's the name of the Parisian sort of running jumping martial art dance?
Yeah, the parkour guy.
But the 80s, the action feels much more, it's sort of, there's something stolid about it. There's something, do you see any change happening during this period?
Well, it's, I think it's the one man, you see, like, and I kind of start the book with Rocky, which is a very tenuous link to the One Man Army movies, but I kind of saw that as the start of, you know, Rocky doesn't have a gun, but he's kind of started that wave, because then you get Rambo, then you get all of Arnold's guys, and you get everyone who follows on. So these one man army movies, you got a lot of them were kind of war films coming out of the 70s, because I think Vietnam was still hanging people's heads. So, you know, things like the Rambo movies, obviously, but then Commando and all the Chuck Norris, you know, Missing in Action movies were all like war films, but with an action hit with one hero. And then I think that started getting stale, and then Die Hard triggers this new thing, which is all about the concept and the setting, and it's got to be in an interesting setting. You've got to have a great bad guy, which you really hadn't had until then in the 80s. It was, you know, you had Steven Berkoff doing his thing in Rambo, and you know, you had Vernon Wells doing his thing in Commando, but you didn't have, I think Gruber like made everyone sit up straight and go, we need to do better. And so you get John Lithgow coming in and doing Cliffhanger, and you get a lot of British and American, like very respectable kind of theater actors coming in and getting killed by Van Damme or Bruce Willis or whatever. But you got all those Die Hard knockoffs, and then I think that took you into the 90s, and then I think Speed came along, and I think Speed was kind of part of that. It's kind of Die Hard on a bus, but brings in, kind of takes it further in terms of who the action hero could be, and Bruce Willis is, a third of the size of Arnold, and then you scale down again with Keanu. And so, yeah, and then as you said, like into the later 90s, you had a lot of, you got the Crouching Tiger stuff, you got the kind of Asian influenced kind of balletic action with wires and everything. I mean, we're in an interesting time now. I don't know what I would say the trend is, because there's, the John Wick films seem to be, everyone seems to be kind of trying to copy John Wick, and you've got very solemn heroes. And I'm a little bit mixed on, I don't know where you stand on the John Wick film. I kind of think they're a bit self-indulgent. I like scenes, but I think they're brilliant. You can't deny the craft of that. Like, you take one scene from a John Wick sequel and you'll be like, holy shit, that's amazing. But then personally, I watch 3 hours of it, and there's so much mythology and there's so much dialogue and philosophy and all this stuff. And I kind of pine a little bit for a 90-minute Arnold movie where it's just very simple and straightforward and things done practically. I mean, it is done. The John Wick films are pretty much done practically, but I don't know where you stand on that stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I think the first one was kind of fun and original and it had its tongue firmly planted in its cheek. I think as it goes on, it becomes more and more, as you say, it becomes laden with this self-importance and I think it's the problem of the universe. No one's making movies anymore. They're creating cinematic universes. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, that's like saying, John Ford made Westerns. He made stories. He didn't make a John Ford universe. There wasn't, he even shot them all a number of them in Monument Valley in the same place. But there was no sense that he was building up some mythology about it. It was just, these are the stories, And any mythology that was goes against the wider cultural mythology. But these,
you don't get a post-credit sting from like
Lee Marvin turns up at the end of the end of the Searchers. So
you think you're the only gunslinger in this valley. I agree, because there's even that John Wick TV show now. So it's like getting so kind of convoluted, and you can't just go and watch like, a fun action movie. It's like you've got to remember what happened in 3 movies and the 4 movies and the TV show now. And it's a lot of homework you have to do.
I think it's like they've decided that movies are like the pig. You can use everything but the oink, So they're expanding. So they get one interesting property and they say, okay, we'll do this, 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 and this, and 2 TV shows and a movie and a trilogy and and in the end, it's just like, the concept itself isn't big enough for those things. It's just you've thinned it all out, and what was interesting is gone, I mean, ultimately, I think it would be better to work harder on coming up with new ideas and letting some of them fail.
Yeah. I mean, my one exception to this, what we've been talking about, might be the new Mad Max film, because if George Miller wants to keep making Mad Max films, then I'm all for it. And but again, I don't think it was very stripped back Fury Road. Like, I don't feel like I need to go back and do a primer on what happened. Obviously, it's a prequel, the new one, Furiosa, but I just think there was something, it's simplicity, I think, that I've come to really appreciate, because The Raid and Mad Max Fury Road are probably my 2 favorite action films from the past 10 years or whatever. Mm. And they're just very simple stories. And there's not tons of weird, plot machinations and exposition and this. They're just very straightforward. You can describe the plot in a couple of lines.
Where do you stand on The Raid 2?
Well, I've only seen it the one time, and I do need to revisit. I've been thinking of revisiting, and I will. I do. The issue I had with it at the time, there was amazing action scenes, and there's a car chase that is absolutely incredible, I remember. But it did bloat it. It sort of felt like it was trying to make it a Godfather film with action, and it kind of lost the simplicity and the elegance of the first one. So I appreciated the ambition, but yeah, it was the first one, I think, for me still.
Yeah. I mean, that's my, you know, I like action movies. I love action movies. They're amazing. Some of my favorite movies are action movies. But I do have this there seems to be this idea of getting a character or getting just getting a character and let's run with it as for until it's dead, until there's nothing. And the other thing that I found with John Wick was the idea of making it emotional in some way, making you think you should care about these characters who just shoot hundreds and hundreds of people in the face. You know, it's just like that's their thing, you know. I get a little bit, I find that a little bit draining, that brutality.
It is. Me too. I get quite numb to it. And also that, you know, he's now a cartoon character. Mm. Like he always kind of was. And I think that's what people liked about him. It's Keanu Reeves in a bulletproof suit, you know, trying to kill the guy, everyone who hurt his dog. But when he fell off the roof, the franchise kind of lost me when he fell off the roof and plummeted, and then he was fine in the next film. And that just kind of pissed me off. I was like, I want some kind of pretense of vulnerability here. Otherwise I can't hang out. You know, it's, you don't think John McClane or James Bond is going to get killed, but in a good Bond movie or a good Die Hard movie, you kind of think he just might, like you're on the edge of your seat. That's kind of their job. And I think, Keanu, John Wick is so unstoppable that, I don't know. It's just, you're just kind of admiring the stunts rather than really getting involved in the action, in the story.
Yeah, that you remind me of Kathy Bates in Misery, talking about the Rocket Man series. You know, he didn't get out of the cockadoodle car. You know, he went off the edge of the cliff.
I relate to her a lot.
Yeah, that's what the meetings in Empire are like when you're arguing your point. I think this is an interesting place for us. Actually interesting that you mentioned the possibility of James Bond dying, because that's another sort of action movie franchise that runs all the way through the 1980s and is is another sort of strand of what action movies can do. I've always thought the good thing about James Bond is he always offers a sort of smorgasbord of different possibilities. You can have a car chase, a ski chase, something in an aeroplane, something hanging from a building, and then a bit of a battle at the end if you want, where he calls in the Marines or the Coast Guard or somebody. Which other characters sort of don't seem to have that ability to do. I did appreciate what happened to him at the end of No Time to Die, even though I think the movie itself wasn't that great. I thought the ending wasn't, was actually the best bit of it. How did you feel about that?
Well, it didn't really land for me massively, as is evidenced from the fact I just said a few minutes ago that you can't imagine Bond actually dying, but he did. I didn't love that last one. I was a bit, you know, the last few, the Craig ones have been up and down for me. I really liked Skyfall, probably because it's the closest to a Roger Moore one, and it's just having fun. I really like Casino Royale, but then I haven't got a lot of time for the others. For some reason it didn't hit me emotionally, and it kind of has to. You have to walk away from that feeling emotional, or it kind of hasn't worked, and maybe it's a failing in me, but I didn't feel it.
It was a question that I was asking on. I don't want to turn this into a Bond-a-thon. Let me instead. What is the future for action movies? Do you feel going forward after now that we're at a point where it seems like superhero movies, which kind of have taken over from action movies, as where we're getting our action from. Are beginning to be on the wane.
Yeah, we're in a very strange time where superhero movies, even a year ago, we wouldn't have been having this conversation, but superhero movies as an entity is starting to buckle and shake, and even Marvel, who are, you know, the gold standard, are kind of faltering, and their films are flopping and they're having a hard time. There's a lot of oversaturation, obviously. I think there's a real appetite for... you know, going back to basics and practical stuff as far as possible. I think, The Raid and Fury Road are kind of beloved films because in different ways they're doing stuff for real. They're out in the desert, or they're doing real, machete fights in a real tower block.
filmed where life is cheap.
And you know, Tom Cruise is flying the flag for that. The one man, you know, one man army that is Tom Cruise, and who knows what he's doing right now, shooting the new Mission Impossible, but apparently it's bananas. So I don't know. I think there's a real appetite for that, but I think there'll always be people will want to see something new. I don't know what that is. I haven't really got the answer, but I think, you know, like every genre, it kind of reinvents itself and there'll be a new wave of things. I don't know what it is. I mean, I not many people like the Avatar films. I'm quite a big fan of them. And I think just from an action filmmaking point of view, the stuff that Cameron's doing is really cutting edge and really kind of exciting. If you take it, you know, if you put aside the dialogue and the characters, which some people have issues with, but I don't think there was enough appreciation for what he was doing in terms of the action stuff, which I think is really kind of amazing. And he still knows how to orchestrate a really crisp, clean action scene, which however big it gets, you can still follow the action, which I think is the main problem with, well, modern action filmmaking. But you know, the Expendables films, you look at them and you, during the action scenes, you have no idea what's going on. And I don't know. I think there'll be old school stuff that people really dig, and I think there'll be, you know, stuff using technology that will be really exciting as well. But I have no idea. That's my long way of saying I have no idea.
You've interviewed all. Did you interview Jackie Chan as well?
I did. I got to go to Shanghai and spend 2 days with Jackie Chan, which were very surreal. Yeah, it was for a DVD, a movie going straight to DVD, and asked the question, can I go to China and meet Jackie Chan? And they said yes. So I met him in this hotel where he was planning his new film, and had a kind of strange dinner with him where he was in quite a bad mood. His film was having problems, and he shouted at me during dinner.
There were just four of us.
I was trying to make small talk, and it wasn't very good. It wasn't very good small talk, but he told me to shut up, and it was quite intense being told to shut up by you know, a man who you've seen kill 1,000 people on screen. He's also, you know, got a reputation of being a nice guy. But then the next day we properly hung out, and he drove me around Shanghai in his car, and he was had Lionel Richie on. He was singing along. We went to watch him record some music. We had dinner again. It was very bizarre. He was being chased. It was like Hard Day's Night at one point. He was being chased down a street by fans, and he and I were like running with his assistant, running into this underground garage. I mean, genuinely, it was like the most surreal 2 days of my life. It was so weird. But I wrote a big article about that. And he has two cuddly pandas, which he bought at Hamleys, and he takes them everywhere with him. There's photos of Keanu Reeves with them, the Obamas with them, and he let me hold these two pandas for about half an hour. I was just holding them. I didn't know what to do with them, but I was like, don't drop them. He'll literally kill me. They're like his sort of best friends, but they're cuddly toys. I had the Jackie Chan experience, and then I've interviewed him a few more times. I did Pints of Milk with him for Empire, and one of the questions was, what's your favorite animal? And he said the panda, because it's the fastest animal on earth. But I didn't challenge him on that. It was an unusual take. But yeah, he's fun. I mean, he's close to Van Damme, I think, in kind of, you never quite know what he's going to say. But he's good fun, apart from when your small talk is not up to snuff.
Yeah. I met him briefly 2 years ago. And I was just a bit gobsmacked, actually. I've seen all those films in the 80s and was really into him, and in the 80s, 90s, really. He's made so much as well.
Has, I mean, yeah. his filmography is and... his filmography is probably like all of these other seven guys put together. Like, he's made so many films, and every single one he's risking his life like eight times. And you're just like, how on earth are you not dead? He's absolutely superhuman.
Yeah. And for some reason, when you were describing driving around with him, I was seeing the early scenes in Zoolander where they drive around in that yellow Jeep. I'm not sure why that's with Wham playing in the background. Lionel Richie or Wham, it's all a... So what's...
Yeah. He was driving very fast as well. I've got to emphasize how fast he was driving. It was quite terrifying. But I was like, I'm in a car with Jackie Chan. If this is the way he goes, then that's ridiculous. You know, he survived more, and we did survive. But yeah, he was a good... And when he let his guard down, it took a little while for him to let his guard down in terms of the interview. But he was kind of interesting. He was quite vulnerable, and he I asked him if he ever gets scared before a stunt, and he said every time. And that's, you'd watch his films, you'd never get that. Like, there's no sense of him being scared. He just throws himself into the stuff. But yeah, he's a human, I guess. Yeah.
Wow. That it makes it all the more admirable in a way.
Mm.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. So what are you working on next, Nick?
I'm working on sleeping. I'm working on just having my day job. I haven't got another book planned. Right. I've got a few very loose ideas, but I've just written some extra content for the paperback, which is out in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And I've written a bunch of stuff for that. But no, beyond that, it's just the day job. It's just Empire and, you know, interesting times to be doing a film magazine. But we kind of got through the strikes and, yeah, just trying to do as good job as we can this year.
Yeah, hopefully into some blue water in 2024 and many, as you know, in cinema as elsewhere. Thanks so much, Nick, for coming and talking to me. I love the book. As you know, I'm a huge fan of the first book. But it's weird. I think this book is actually funnier than the book about the comedians. That's not to say that the book about the comedians needs to be necessarily funny. You know, it has its own, it's fascinating in its own way. But this was full of so many stories where I was crying with laughter at times.
Well, they're kind of accidentally funny, these guys. They're not trying to be, which kind of makes it, yeah. But thank you very, very much.
It's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.